Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, a weekly public affairs series featuring scholars and visitors at the center. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute which encourages excellence in scholarship and seeks to affirm the importance of the humanities in American life.
I mean, if you think about it, if you don't have any language, and somebody points and says, "This is a dog," how do you know what the "this" is? Because someone's always pointing to an entire scene, to an entire array. They could be trying to direct your attention to any aspect of that.
Metaphor, poetic capabilities are the foundation of our thought. They're the foundation of our ideology and of what it means to have a poetic life. But if we look at our everyday language, we find that we are one with the poets in how we think about basic concepts.
Language and meaning, this week on Soundings. First, a conversation with Louise Anthony, a professor of philosophy at North Carolina State University. Following that, I'll talk with Mark Turner, a professor of English at the University of Chicago. During her fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Louise Anthony is working on a project entitled Meanings, Inside and Out. Louise Anthony, welcome to Soundings. Why is language such a tough problem for philosophers?
Well, tough problem. Let's see. Let's start with why it's interesting to philosophers. There are a couple of independent reasons why philosophers get interested in language. One is that it's just an inherently interesting phenomenon. I mean, here we are, these creatures on this planet, and we do this thing that no one else does. No other thing seems to be able to do. So how is that possible? So just the description of the phenomenon is of interest, and of course it's of interest to psychologists and linguists as well as philosophers. But even before that, there's a very long-standing tradition in philosophy to think of language as a kind of window into the mind, that the structure of our language reveals the structure of the mind.
Is it fair to say, just parenthetically, that some philosophers agree or disagree about whether language is the mind?
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, this is very controversial. I mean, there are lots of different positions you could take. You could say language is, the structure of language is the structure of the mind. You could say the structure of language derives from the structure of the mind. Some philosophers think that it's been a mistake to link language in the mind because they don't think there's a mind in some sense. That is, they think, well, Wittgenstein, for example, argued, among other things, that a preoccupation with the structure of language has led people to think that there's some kind of structured mentality that lies behind it and explains it.
He thinks
that's wrong.
This is the man who said, "The limits of my language, what are the limits of my world?" Something
yes,
like that.
Yes. Now, well, this is Wittgenstein came in two flavors. There was early Wittgenstein and late Wittgenstein.
And this was what, early?
Yes. The early Wittgenstein had a very rationalistic picture of the world and of the mind. And
in other words, if I can't say it, I really am not thinking it.
Absolutely. Yeah. He said that. I quote this to my students all the time.
Uh-huh.
If you can't say it clearly, you can't think it clearly either.
Right.
But he had a very beautiful picture in the Tractatus of language and mind as being structured, and of that structure being the logical structure of the world, which was also the rationalist picture.
All right, now tell me what you're interested in, Louise Anthony. You're moving, what, back from this Wittgenstein formulation that there's something, what do you call it, pre-linguistic or structural in our heads that creates?
Well, before I say what I'm interested in, let me mention a third source of interest.
Fair enough.
Because this is important. Along around the time of Wittgenstein, right around the end of the 19th century, came something in philosophy that's become known as the linguistic turn.
The
Richard
linguistic
Rorty, I think,
turn.
Coined this phrase.
All
yeah.
Right.
And this was a turn. this was what happened in philosophy was that people began to get the idea that somehow or other whole sets of philosophical issues that weren't overtly connected to language could be illuminated or even solved by paying attention to language. So you have language as an inherently interesting phenomenon. You have language as potentially revealing mental structures, structure of thought. And now you have language as the potential source of solutions to traditionally vexing philosophical problems.
So it is philosophy, and yet it is an approach to philosophy at the same time. Language.
Yes, uh-huh. Yes. Now, some people became very dogmatic about this, which I don't necessarily think is bad, but I mean, they really thought that, well, they became proselytizers. Looking at language was going to dissolve or solve philosophical problems, mm-hmm. metaphysical problems. What kinds of things exist? Willard Van Orman Quine, one of my teachers, thought that attention to the language that we use was going to answer that question. In fact, provided the only answer to that question. He said you have to look at the kinds of things that you have to refer to in order to construct theories of the world. So looking at language is going to tell you what things actually are in the world.
Uh-huh. Well, let me bring you back to your project, Louise Anthony. We're talking about language. We're mm-hmm. talking about philosophy. What are the tough nuts here that you're trying to crack?
Okay, I'm specifically worried about what meaning is. Mm-hmm. The kind of standard way of thinking about this is that there are three components to language broadly. There's the syntactic component, the rules that govern which words fall, come after another.
Structural stuff.
Right.
Okay.
Then there are the semantics, and that is how contents get assigned to these symbols that are put together in accordance with the syntactic rules. Then there are pragmatics, the sorts of things that govern what it's relevant to say in certain circumstances, what it isn't, govern your particular choice of words to express a given thought, and so forth. Now, within philosophy, most attention has been paid to syntax and semantics. And my interest is in semantics, which is not to say that I don't think the other two are important or interesting. What I want to know is, what kind of systematic relationship is there between the words that we use and elements of the world that we're using those words to talk about?
All right. Now, do you approach this, Louise Anthony, at the level of popular culture, politics? What is it that compels you to try to find meaning in meaning?
I want to know why dog refers to dogs.
Uh-huh.
When we do that, I think democracy and love are going to be a snap.
I see.
Okay. It's a very mundane concern.
But isn't this something that you could go to the Oxford English Dictionary and figure out, what, simply the etymology of a word and look back and say, all right, if you want to look at it mythically, Adam's in the Garden of Eden, mm-hmm. and God says, you name them and you got them. You can control them.
Good.
So he comes along and says, well, I don't know what D-O-G is, but we're going to call that a D-O-G.
That's terrific. You said two things that I think are really germane here. One is, can't you just go to the dictionary and find mm-hmm. out what words mean?
Right.
The other was, doesn't Genesis give us a theory of meaning? In fact, Genesis, the story that you just recounted, is an incipient theory of meaning, the one that I think is in the end right, and that is that words are labels that we slap on bits of the world. They're meaningless sound things in the world.
But it doesn't have to be biblical necessarily. It's just the question of precedent. It's just that who gets there the firstest with whatever we want to call meaning, right?
Who gets there the firstest?
Well, for example, here up the street at the Microelectronics Center, a scientist is working on a silicon chip and develops mm-hmm. a new physical gizmo that is like a silicon chip but is really not like it.
Mm-hmm.
And he calls it a whiz-bang.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody says, well, fair enough, that's what this thing is going to be, and we don't need to worry about this semantic balancing act.
Okay, suppose Adam says, look, God said I could do this, so I get to say what a dog is, all right? And along comes a German shepherd, and he says, dog. Okay.
Right.
Along comes a French poodle.
Uh-huh.
Is that a dog or isn't it?
Well,
Adam didn't name that particular animal.
Uh-huh.
He named the German Shepherd.
So what? Now we're dealing with categories as well as individual instances.
Well, right. I mean, that's we have two kinds of names, mm-hmm. in English anyway, common names and proper names.
Right.
And they both pose the same question in slightly different ways. The common names pose the following question. Suppose you got it, you grasped that Adam wanted the German Shepherd to be called a dog, okay? How do you grasp what range of things like German Shepherds Adam intends that name to apply to, mm-hmm. too? That is, you know, well, I don't know Adam, but probably what he meant was not just that that particular individual animal be called dog, but that everything like it. Now, the really interesting thing, well, one interesting thing about human beings is they seem to natively, or at least very early on, understand this likeness relationship.
And this goes to your investigation, mm-hmm. what, that there is something structural in our minds that assists that understanding?
Well, that's the assumption that makes sense to me in light of what I've, the arguments and the evidence that I've looked like. It's of course, very largely an empirical issue. It's something for psychologists to investigate as well as philosophers. But that's the kind of working hypothesis I've got, that we are sort of built to recognize certain natural categories. What drove me into philosophy was wanting to understand my place, the place of people, of creatures like me, in the world of nature. Mm-hmm. There are ways in which human beings are clearly natural beings. We're subject, unfortunately, to disease and gravity and all these other things. But there are also these ways in which we seem to be quite anomalous, quite unique. I want to know how that works.
Just a little bit below the angels, that kind of stuff?
Well, maybe, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, maybe even above them. I mean, we have free will, right? And they don't, uh-huh. according to some theologies. So it's a matter of understanding the place of human beings in nature, and that I think is that underlies a lot of my more specific quest for self-understanding. Mm-hmm. I think it ties in with concerns about free will and determinism. You know, if we're simply another part of the natural order, maybe we're not free. Where does that leave moral responsibility? So there are a lot of questions that are interesting to me personally, as a political and a moral actor, that don't tie directly into my work on language, but are part of the same kind of quest for self-understanding. I don't seek to contribute to the well-being of the world in my philosophical endeavors. I would be delighted if there were some payoff there, but that's not what I seek. I seek to understand the mind. That doesn't mean that I'm not concerned with making the world a better place, but I'm concerned with that qua human being, not qua philosopher. And I think that anybody that would be willing to leave it to the philosophers or the ethicists or the political scientists to deal with that realm has missed the fundamental feature of the liberal conception of democracy.
There's too much at stake, huh?
Well, it's one of what we're it's one of the things I think we're supposed to be doing with these incredible faculties that we find ourselves with as human beings.
The program is Soundings. This is Wine Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion with Louise Antony of North Carolina State University. During her fellowship year at the center, Louise Antony is working on a project entitled Meanings, Inside and Out. Soundings on Language and Meaning continues. My guest now is Mark Turner, a professor of English at the University of Chicago. Mark Turner is co-author of More Than Cool Reason, a field guide to poetic metaphor, published last year by the University of Chicago Press. During his fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, he's working on a book about analogy.
An analogy is any variety of things. There's a great deal to debate about what an analogy is. To ask what an analogy is a question that has different meanings to different people. Some people think, for instance, that a statement can be an analogy, that a piece of language can be an analogy.
You're full of baloney, I say.
Right.
Is that an analogy?
And they say those words are an analogy.
Right.
Other people tend to think that an analogy is something that happens at the level of mind. Hmm. So that, for instance, if you're considering how electricity is like running water, it's a conceptual analogy. And part of the question is, how do statements that people take as analogies interconnect with these conceptual analogies?
All right, now, at what level are you approaching all of this?
Let's take you're full of baloney. Okay. I approach things usually...
You're really not, of course, but...
Yeah, I approach things usually at the level of baloney. You said you're full of baloney. Is that an analogy?
Mm-hmm.
The idea that you're full of baloney would be an analogy itself depends upon an analogy or a metaphor which is very deep in our conception, and that is the conduit metaphor.
Say that again?
The conduit metaphor.
The conduit metaphor.
This was discovered and elaborated by Michael Reddy in the 1970s. Absolutely groundbreaking, fundamental work. Michael Reddy pointed out that we tend to think of language by analogy, by metaphor, with a container.
Huh.
We say, I'm putting my meaning into words.
All right. Now, is the container one's mind?
No, the container is the words.
The words.
And what you put into the container is your meanings.
Uh-huh.
You think of meanings as objects and language as a container. Let me give you an example. We have many, many metaphoric utterances for talking about life and death. And they come from a metaphoric, a bodily understanding, a physical understanding. It's metaphoric, in which life is presence here, and death is absence. Life is a journey that has an end, and death is a departure. So there is a myth, very easily accepted in our society, that ordinary language and poetic language are two entirely different things.
What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's mistaken, and my job is to show how it's mistaken. It's crucial that it is mistaken.
Hmm.
The concept is that poets do things utterly differently from the way you and I do them.
Yeah,
you and I just talk.
Fine madness, all of that.
But these are geniuses.
Yeah.
You know, the poets... The poet's eye in a fine frenzy rolling doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven. You get the idea.
Right.
He's like the poet, the madman, and the fool, you know. They're these marginal characters.
They've been inspired. I mean, in the original sense, they're full of these crazy spirits that...
And they do things that are entertaining and decorative and so on, but they don't have anything to do with our real lives.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, now that's not true. Take, for instance, this conception we had just a minute ago of death as departure.
Mm-hmm.
He's left us. You know, the doctor comes out and says, he almost slipped away, but we managed to pull him back.
Yeah.
Away implies death, and back implies life.
Uh-huh.
That's metaphoric. Now take Emily Dickinson. Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality.
Uh-huh.
You look at this poem, and many, many others besides, like Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night, many, 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 are elaborations of this basic, fundamental, ineradicable, irreducible, ordinary conception that we have of our very lives and deaths as being present here during life and departing in a death. What poets are doing there is not inventing these wildly strange things. If they were, we couldn't understand them. What they're doing is taking conceptions that we already live by. Poetic techniques, things that supposedly only poets use, are the staple of our lives. Metaphoric conceptualization is something that we use constantly.
But we don't use it consciously.
Exactly. And that makes it all the more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
These poetic forms of thought are so basic to us, so unconscious and automatic, that we don't even notice them, and that makes them all the more powerful. They're entrenched for two reasons. First off, because they're indispensable. When you think abstractly about factoring something in, or looking into your mind, or pulling something into consciousness, all of that's metaphoric on the basis of in and out, which you actually experience physically in your everyday life.
Right.
But you don't realize it. You don't realize it at all. These things are indispensable, but they're also powerful because you don't notice them.
Well,
that which is automatic resists being noticed. And if you can't notice something, then you can't change it.
Let's pause on this word that you've just used, Mark Turner, power. It's, again, fashionable in the academy these days to talk about literature and poetry, novels, in terms of who has power and who doesn't have power. Does that mean that there's an ideological dimension to what you're doing here, trying to figure out... it goes back to the notion of Adam naming things and therefore having control over them. Am I on the right track there?
Absolutely. There certainly is an ideological component. I would hope that the component is providing tools for locating and analyzing ideologies rather than pushing any particular ideology.
So your work is descriptive and not proscriptive in any sense.
I hope so. Yeah. And let me give you an example. One of the most concrete and ubiquitous conceptual metaphors that we use unconsciously, automatically, is the great chain metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
We use the great chain of being ideologically because the great chain of being, as a conceptual folk theory, is taken not just as a description of what is, but what ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
So that, for instance, when I say something like the cat decides, or the rats decide the cat ought to be belled, suppose there's something happening politically, and I make a judgment on this and express it as the rats decide the cat ought to be belled. Well, now you know that the rats are below the cat. And if the rats are deciding the cat ought to be belled, what I'm really saying is that a bunch of lower, mediocre, unqualified folk are unjustly, unnaturally trying to constrain the powers of something that is their natural superior.
Yeah, you're either a neo-Marxist here, or you are some sort of egalitarian ideal thinker, that kind of thing.
But you see, there's an ideology implicit in that comment.
Mm-hmm.
We've just said something metaphoric. We've talked about people in terms of cats and rats. It's metaphoric on the basis of this great chain. We have this tendency to try to explain higher order capacities in terms of lower order attributes on the great chain. Like, I say of someone, all bark and no bite,
right.
Or I say of someone, big thunder, little rain, meaning brags a lot,
right.
But doesn't accomplish much.
Uh-huh.
Now, we do this all the time, and what we're doing is mapping from something at one level of the great chain to something at another level of the great chain, and it carries with it the ideology of stratification. In the great chain, for instance, in the extended great chain, women are below men.
Mm-hmm.
And so consequently, keeping them in line is just common sense.
Right.
If you change your metaphor, then suddenly the common sense evaporates.
Right, the last shall be first and the first last.
Exactly.
Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, Mark Turner. We're talking about analogy, metaphor, the ways language works at conscious and unconscious levels. In what general or public sense is this stuff important?
It was just to answer this question that George Lakoff and I wrote More Than Cool Reason, A Field Guide to Poetic Metaphor.
Hmm.
Which is just out, and which we wrote in a style that we hope is accessible to college freshmen and sophomores. What it's attempting to do is show them how they think, or some capacity that they have to think. Now, consciousness is so strong. We, as a species, are designed to notice what is novel and new and nuanced, that we come to think that conscious thought is all of thought.
Hmm.
And it's just that I'm trying to undo. Consciousness, what goes on in consciousness, is the smallest, smallest sliver of what we are in fact doing. Conscious decision is the smallest sliver of our actual deciding.
That's just the end of the process.
It's a small bit that surfaces into consciousness, if it ever does at all. And we tend to think that that's what we have to look at. Of course it's what we have to look at. That's why it's in consciousness. But it doesn't mean that it's what is going on, or even that it's dominantly what's going on. Most of what's going on is unconscious. And at a level of systematicity and power that we're just not aware of, my project is to try to reveal some of this systematicity so that we can have more control over our ideology, our conceptions of ourselves, our conceptions of our life. So it's in that way that I hope that this isn't an academic pursuit. This is really about what shall our foreign policy be and what are the conceptions on which it is based. What is our notion of the relation of the individual to the state and how does that come about? What is our notion of a right? Do trees have standing to sue if somebody wants to cut them down? Do the unborn have rights? What constitutes life? Now there, for instance, is a conception which is currently fueling debate in the pro-life versus pro-choice arena across the nation. And if you look at the debates, you'll see that each side is trying to configure the conception of life in such a way. Through language that enables its own ideology, right? It's those capacities for conceptualization and how they're linked to language that I look at. And I assume that that is of interest to everyone who has a human life.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation with Mark Turner of the University of Chicago. During his fellowship year at the center, Mark Turner is working on a book about analogy. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip is 27709. Ask for program number 498. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, Politics and History in Ancient Greece. My guest will be Philip Statter of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Josiah Ober of Montana State University, and Robert Connor, director of the National Humanities Center. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. 78 years ago this week brought news of the sinking of the unsinkable luxury liner, the Titanic. More than 1,500 people lost their lives. 6 years before that, in mid-April 1906, 4,000 people died in the earthquake that leveled 10,000 acres in San Francisco. The city of Rome celebrates a birthday this week. According to tradition, Rome was founded in mid-April of the year 753 of the Common Era. Massachusetts and Maine celebrate Patriots Day this week in commemoration of the Battle of Lexington and Concord in 1775. In mid-April 1862, Congress abolished slavery in the District of Columbia. Giovanni Verrazzano, the Florentine navigator, discovered New York Harbor in mid-April 1524. Mid-April birthdays include Hans Sloane, the physician and naturalist whose collection became the nucleus of the British Museum. He was born in mid-April 1660. Thornton Wilder, the American playwright, was born in mid-April 1897. The German dictator, Adolf Hitler, was born in mid-April 1889. And finally, the world's first woman prime minister, Sedimavo Bandaranaike, was born in mid-April 1916. She served in Sri Lanka, formerly known as Ceylon. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Language and Meaning, this week on Soundings. Louise Antony of North Carolina State University discusses her study, Meanings Inside and Out. Mark Turner of the University of Chicago discusses his study of metaphor and analogy. How does language work? Of all the life on Earth, why is it peculiar to human beings? Language and Meaning, this week on Soundings.